Cast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we'll try to get a glimpse into the world of intelligence. Our guest is Patrick Radden Keefe, author of Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping. Keefe examines a number of questions in this book, including how does the government eavesdrop, who's being listened in on, and can this eavesdropping predict and prevent terror attacks? Are we safer because of this surveillance? Patrick Keefe became interested in global eavesdropping when he was a student in the United Kingdom in the late 1990s. Stories were appearing there in the papers about something called Echelon. The stories, Keefe says, painted an intriguing picture. The picture was, he says, quoting here, of a dramatic eavesdropping architecture wrapping itself grid-like around the globe, an invisible infrastructure where a select handful of agencies could tap into the chatter of nations and garner an Olympian omniscience, literally hearing everything all the time. Keefe was hooked on the story. He set out to find out how chatter works. He says the story he found is, in his words, that of an epic struggle between two abstract concepts, security and privacy, that is playing out amid lightning-fast technological and social change. Listeners, you can join the discussion. I invite your questions and comments. I look forward to your phone calls. Join us on the telephone, the number on the in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Patrick Radden Keefe is a third-year student at Yale Law School. He has written articles for a number of publications, including the New York Review of Books and Slate. Chatter, Keefe's first book, is published by Random House. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. The numbers if you'd like to join the discussion. Patrick Radden Keefe, thanks so much for joining us this
afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, to begin here, tell us, first of all, who's listening and what are they listening for?
Well, I think what a lot of people probably don't realize is that the biggest, you know, when we think of spies, we think of, I think a lot of people still think of sort of Cold War era men in trench coats.
Smiley.
Exactly, George Smiley or James Bond, I guess a man in a tuxedo. But actually, the biggest thing that U.S. intelligence does now is electronic intelligence. So the agency that I write about, the National Security Agency, a lot of people haven't even heard of it, but it's actually bigger than the CIA and the FBI combined. And it's able to intercept billions of phone calls and emails from all over the planet every day.
Yeah. Now, the National Security Agency was created in 1952, and it was kept completely under wraps for 20-some years, and we don't know very much about this agency. Would you give us a quick overview of its functions?
Well, basically, it has two main functions. One is communication security, which involves pretty much making codes, strong encryption algorithms for U.S. policymakers and politicians so that, you know, other countries aren't able to eavesdrop on us. And then the other is eavesdropping and code breaking, and that's the biggest function of the agency. It's got about 60,000 employees, roughly 40,000 of whom work at the headquarters, which is in Fort Meade, Maryland, and then another 20,000 of whom work at these listening stations all over the planet. And it has a massive budget. I mean, the actual number is a secret, a very closely guarded secret, but it's estimated to be as much as $6 billion a year.
Hmm. You report that every 3 hours, the National Security Agency's satellites pick up enough information to fill the Library of Congress. Is it possible to really to listen to that amount of information?
Well, no, and that's actually one of the big problems is that it's funny, you know, they talk about the intelligence cycle,
mm-hmm.
where you have intelligence collection and then intelligence production. And collection is when you go out there and you get as much information as you possibly can. And then production is when you sort of sort through that and you try to find the useful information. It's sort of a needle in a haystack thing. The problem is that the better we get at intelligence collection, picking up these emails and phone calls from all over the planet, the harder it gets to do intelligence production, to zero in very quickly on the chatter, as they say, that is useful and is going to tell us something. And so, for instance, another of the problems is that even after you've zoomed in on the particular communications you're interested in, often they're in another language, and you have to translate those communications. And, you know, we had a story come out last year that the FBI is currently sitting on hundreds of hours of taped conversations between Al-Qaeda suspects that haven't been translated yet from the Arabic.
Yeah. Well, who is of interest? Al-Qaeda is certainly of interest. Who's being listened to? Who pops up at the head of the pack?
All kinds of people. I mean, it's astonishing. Obviously, you have all of the various terrorist groups and foreign governments, the sort of so-called rogue states, Iran, North Korea, what have you. But then we also listen very carefully to diplomats, which is something that a lot of people, I think, didn't realize. One thing that I write about is that it came out a few years ago that in the run-up to the UN Security Council's vote on whether or not there should be an authorization for an invasion of Iraq, it came out that U.S. intelligence, the National Security Agency, was eavesdropping on delegates to the UN Security Council and their offices in New York to try and figure out what their positions would be and then try and use that to persuade them to give a yes vote for the authorization.
Yeah. Well, tell us about Catherine Gunn and how that story found its way to the newspapers.
Well, the way that story first came out was that, in fact, what happened was that somebody in the NSA who was in charge of targeting who should be eavesdropped on sent an email memo to GCHQ, which is, it stands for Government Communications Headquarters, always very bland, bureaucratic names, but this is the big agency in the United Kingdom that we work very closely with. When you hear people talk about the Echelon network, it's primarily the U.S. and the U.K., and then also Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, working very closely on getting communications from all over the world. So it was not unusual that somebody from the American eavesdropping agency would make a request to the British agency, but he sent this email, and this young woman named Catherine Gunn got the email, and she was living in England. She's a British woman. And she had been working as a translator of Chinese. So what she would do is she would come into work at the British Eavesdropping Agency every day and put on headphones and listen to conversations between Chinese diplomats and politicians and translate those intercepted communications. And she felt that that the memo was asking her to do something that she was uncomfortable with because she was personally opposed to the war and she thought that the UN should be allowed to go through its normal deliberative process. It's also, incidentally, illegal to listen in on UN delegates. The U.S. and the U.K. have both signed treaties saying that they won't. And so what she did was she leaked the memo. She took the memo, the email that she'd gotten from this guy at the NSA, and she showed it to somebody who eventually put it in The Observer, the London newspaper The Observer, and it was on the front page. And it ended up being a big story pretty much everywhere in the world, except for in the United States, where there was very little coverage of it here at all.
Yeah. Why was the story slow to circulate here?
I think there are a number of answers. I mean, the easy one is that journalists are very... American journalists almost have an allergy to writing about this kind of intelligence. And I think that part of the reason is you have cautionary tales. So in 1998, a Washington newspaper published a story that said that U.S. intelligence was able to listen in on the satellite phone of Osama bin Laden. And the day the story ran, he stopped using the phone and hasn't used it since. So you have these cautionary tales that basically say, be careful when you write about this stuff, because if you do, you know, if you say that we can listen to someone, they'll stop talking on that line. Or worse yet, they'll actually feed us disinformation because they know we're listening. Combined with that, there's a great deal of secrecy that these agencies practice. The joke is that NSA doesn't stand for National Security Agency. It stands for no such agency, or never say anything. And so it's, if you're an American journalist, generally you won't run a major newspaper story unless you can corroborate it. So you might be lucky enough to
and
have
nobody's
one.
Talking.
Pardon?
And nobody's talking.
Well, exactly. I mean, you might be lucky enough to have one person come and tell you a story, but the likelihood that somebody else will. And so it's funny, actually, that story I just told you about the eavesdropping on UN delegates in New York, this whole operation was taking place on the east side of Manhattan, but the New York Times didn't run a single article about it. And somebody actually asked the deputy editor of the New York Times, a woman named Allison Smale, why they hadn't done so. And she said, oh, well, we're very interested in this story, but we contacted the Pentagon, and they wouldn't confirm it. They said no comment. I mean, of course they did. This shouldn't be entirely surprising, but...
Yeah. I have a listener waiting to talk with us, so let's go and talk with a caller in Urbana on line one, and then we'll come back and pick up and follow up on some of the things that you just talked about. Let's go and talk with a listener in Urbana, line one. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry to jump in so early, but I have to listen to this show mostly on the radio. I got to go someplace, but I was wondering two things. Well, actually, I guess three. One is there any way you can kind of surmise that that Echelon has trained its ears on South America as well as Europe?
Do you want me to take these questions one at a time? Okay, I can take that
sure.
One first. I would imagine that it is. We know that that we have bases that have covered, you know, listening stations that are supposed to cover that whole hemispheric area. I didn't come across particular stories, but I think it's more than likely that we would. I mean, when this whole system was first set up, the aim was really to have total coverage of the globe. So South America would certainly not be exempt.
Mm. And two other questions. I think I'll ask them and just hang up. One is, I understand, I've got this article from the International Herald Tribune a couple years old that mentions electronic voting coming up in Britain, and it talks about security checks being done by what looks like Kinetic and Echelon. I'm wondering if this is the same Echelon, or maybe there's a company called Echelon as well. And then two, I was wondering if you had any idea whether this spy network, which some people have called the part of the Anglosphere, has spurred. It might be one of the main reasons why the Chinese and the Japanese are getting into space programs. And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Thank you. I'll take those both in turn. In the first case, I suspect that's probably a company. I doubt that. I mean, even if this network were being used to look in on voter registration issues, it would never come out that it was. I mean, that would be a very closely held secret. So I suspect that's probably a company called Echelon. As for the second question, I mean, that this whole issue of sort of almost an arms race with this kind of technology is really fascinating and is something that's come up. So one of the ways I first learned about Echelon was that the European Parliament was doing an investigation of it. This is back in the late 90s. A number of European countries were very agitated because they worried about privacy rights, and one of the big things they were also worried about was that these kinds of technologies would be used to steal, to do industrial espionage, to steal trade secrets and give them to American or British corporations. But what's interesting is that the reaction on the part of some of these European countries was to protest, but then also to develop their own surveillance capabilities. So it was actually a joke at the time. The French were very exercised about this, but it then came out that the French had a similar system of their own, which was then dubbed Frenchelon. So you do have a number of different countries trying to develop these kinds of capabilities.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Yes, thank you. years ago, I read James Bamford's book, Puzzle Palace. And so one thing, I'm sort of curious how you may have built on that work, things that, you know, I'm sure you've updated somewhat, but things that maybe he didn't reveal that, you know, you've come across. And also, in that book, he referenced the University of Illinois and, you know, recruiting here. And I'm just wondering, you know, if you came across any links to your research projects at the U of I or, you know, recruiting going on here, that sort of thing, connections between the university and the NSA.
Great questions, both. Yeah, the Bamford wrote The Puzzle Palace. It was the first book on the NSA, and it came out in the early 80s. And obviously a great deal has since transpired to sort of, you know, I mean, there has been a need for a follow-up. And in fact, he did do a follow-up, a book called Body of Secrets, which came out just before 9/11. And I didn't actually start my book. I mean, I had started my research in the late 90s, but I didn't start researching the book as a book in earnest until after 9/11. So, I mean, in a way, you know, what I bring to the table is a lot of sort of looking at how this works with terrorist groups and what have you. I mean, a whole series of concerns that you couldn't really have been, you couldn't be faulted for not having addressed prior to 2001. As for recruitment, I haven't come across anything particularly referring to U of I, but I know that there's been a huge push since September 11th for the NSA in particular to try and develop better relations with universities in two particular respects. The first is technology, that for years the NSA was actually light years ahead of private or academic R&D in technology issues. But during the 80s and the 90s, it actually has been sort of surpassed by Silicon Valley and by a lot of mathematical cryptographers at universities. And so it's really trying now to develop better relations with academia and actually take advantage of some of that insight and research. The second major area is languages. One thing we realized on September 11th is that we don't have enough linguists who speak the kinds of languages that a lot of America's adversaries do. And it's funny, you know, you always hear about Arabic, and Arabic is obviously an issue, but it's also much more sort of Pashto and Urdu, Baluch, which is a dialect spoken by only about 150,000 people in the world. And so there's been a big push in the last two or three years to try and cooperate with and recruit from universities, and I'm sure the Illinois system is included.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions are invited. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest in this portion of the program, Patrick Radden Keefe, author of Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping. Listeners, you can join us with a telephone call. Your questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another listener, line one, Champaign County.
Hi. It's interesting you suggest that this doesn't get talked about much because they can't double source. I was haranguing some journalists yesterday about on this very show about the fact that Judith Miller gets away with single sourcing on her stories. So if it goes in favor of the U.S. government, apparently you can publish single source stories. But you can't do the anything that's critical or would be looked at askance by the government. I wanted you to talk about Men with Hill. Now, I assume you're over there. Maybe this is a huge establishment. I think they have their own power plant, actually, for the – this is the Echelon listening station.
Mm-hmm.
It's virtually a town, yeah.
Yeah. But some details on that. The reason why I know about it is not so much looking at Echelon is because it's also the site for U.S. – UK cooperation with on missile defense, so-called, and there's been a lot of agitation demonstrations at the place. It seems, you know, that this should have been reported in the U.S. press more than it has, and I think it's just the whole aura of secrecy even before 9/11 that the journalists can't talk about these things, et cetera, because it's against the national security, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, great questions. As to your comment, which I'll just take quickly first, yeah, I think things have gotten a lot worse. I think that the current administration is particularly secretive and has, I think that Mr. Ari Fleischer, who's currently making the rounds with his book, developed a real sort of strong-arm tactic as far as playing favorites with journalists. And I think that whether your stories were supportive of the administration or critical did have a great deal to do with how much access you got. As for Memwith Hill, what the caller's referring to is the single biggest eavesdropping station on the planet, which is actually in the middle of the British countryside in Yorkshire, in the moors. But it's an American eavesdropping station, and there are 1,200 American eavesdroppers who live there. I went to this base, and it's a 500-acre site surrounded in barbed wire. And it's amazing, you're in the middle of pasture land and there are cows and sort of crumbling stone walls, and it really looks like nothing has changed for 1,000 years. And then you come up over a hill and you see these massive white globes. They look like big golf balls, and there are about 24 of these. And they contain satellite dishes and are used for intercepting communications satellite, you know, commercial communication satellite traffic. And in this manner, this base intercepts millions and millions of communications every day, and you have actually three shifts, I found out, so that people are up at all hours of the night processing this information. And it has been involved in missile defense as well over the years. It's been a real sort of locus for American and British cooperation on these issues. And I actually, one of the things I write about in the book is I attended a protest by a bunch of British peace protesters who, on the 4th of July, they held an Independence from America Day protest. So I was the only American present, sort of scribbling notes and walking around the base with them. A fascinating place.
Uh-huh. There's a joke about NSA that they measure their computer capacity in acres.
In acres, yeah.
Yeah, and that I think that's from Bamford, too. I'm not sure, because I did read both of those Body of Secrets and earlier Puzzle Palace, but this goes back into the history, but it reminds me, there's another huge listening station in Australia.
Pine Gap.
In the mid-70s, the allegation is, and I think this is from Bamford, that it actually caused a coup, sort of a constitutional coup, because the incoming mildly leftist party wanted to throw him out, and since Australia was part of the Commonwealth, they actually used the Governor General, the Queen's advocate, to dissolve the Parliament and reconstitute so that this listening station wasn't lost. And it's amazing that's not a common place. I mean, every Australian probably knows about it. They may feel different ways about it, but they at least know about this. And this is part of the. This goes back to the mid-70s.
The history of our relationship. Yeah, it was actually Whitlam was the name of the Prime Minister who was removed by the Governor General. I think the only time that's happened in Australian history. And it was because he had actually been deceived about the presence of this base. This is, again, in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the Australian desert, is a base called Pine Gap, which intercepts communications again and also had a nuclear role, an important nuclear role. And Whitlam was the new prime minister, and he had been told that it was managed by Australians and that there was a real sort of Australian oversight function. And he learned that this was not the case. It was all run by the CIA, and they didn't really they weren't all that accountable to the Australian government. And he started making speeches about this and made one too many and was eventually taken out of office. I mean, one of the interesting things, actually, that I found in my research was that often the political structures in the countries involved don't actually have a great deal of oversight or understanding of what the agencies do, which sort of runs contrary to the way, I mean, you wouldn't think that a prime minister or parliament, or in our case, Congress, would be hopeless. But in the late 1990s, Porter Goss, who is now the head of the CIA and was then the chair of the House Intelligence Oversight Committee, said to the NSA, look, we've been hearing stories about Echelon. We want to know how you use these capabilities. We want to know, do you use them against American people? What are your internal guidelines? And the NSA said, we'd love to tell you, but we're not going to. It's too secret.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Patrick Radden Keefe, author of Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Patrick, you're not an investigative journalist. How did you go about trying to discover the workings of the world of chatter?
Well, it was difficult. I mean, I guess, as you guessed from what I've said so far, a lot of it was figuring out where these bases are and going to them and actually sort of wandering around. And, you know, they would never let me in, but I could talk to people in the community and people who'd worked there. And a lot of it was talking to former spies, people who had worked as eavesdroppers and sort of proceeding sideways in a way in that manner, because I would meet one person and they would come to trust me and we would go back and forth and they would introduce me to someone else. And then a lot of it, I had to use a lot of ingenuity. I mean, the NSA wouldn't talk to me, which was not a big surprise. But I found all kinds of information in places you wouldn't really expect it. So, for instance, I actually went to the USPTO, the Patent and Trademark Office, and because the NSA has fallen a little bit behind technologically in the last 20 years, they've started taking out patents on their inventions because, you know, there's a concern that somebody else might duplicate an invention and get a right to it. But the devil's bargain of patent law is that you need to publish information about what the invention consists of. So if you go actually even to the website of the USPTO and do a search for NSA, you find that they have about 200 patents listed on the site. So there are a whole series of technologies that I was curious about that if I had just, you know, rang them up, called the Public Affairs Office, they wouldn't have been very enthusiastic to discuss with me. But by kind of doing it the roundabout way and finding other ways of getting the information, all information that was in the public record, but, you know, wasn't necessarily out there in the most obvious place, I was able to compile a fairly detailed picture of the way they work.
Hmm. You know, talked a little bit earlier about the cautionary tales that journalists tell one another, and the story of when the press reported the U.S. was listening to Bin Laden, and he stopped using the phone. You know, there are those who say talking about the eavesdropping capabilities of the U.S. and the U.K. helps the bad guys. What do you think?
I think it's an important point, and one that I had in mind as I did my research and my writing. In fact, there's stuff that I didn't put in the book because I think that you really do need to be cautious. And I mean, perhaps it's because I'm not an investigative journalist, but I didn't feel the need. There wasn't a sort of a conveyor belt between me learning something and it going right into the book. I had to sort of be judicious about what was going to go in there and what was not. Having said that, if there's one thing I realized in looking at the way in which particularly our terrorist adversaries, particularly groups like Al-Qaeda, work, and the way they do their own communications and their own intelligence, one thing I came away with is that they are very shrewd, and they keep a very close eye on us. And given that, you know, while much of the stuff in my book would be pretty surprising to the average reader, a lot of it was in the public realm. I mean, things like those patents. And I think that it's very unlikely that America's enemies would be learning anything new from our book.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Belgium, line 4. Hi.
Good afternoon. Hello?
Hello.
Oh, go ahead.
Good afternoon. Just to point out just how they have a certain culture in NSA. Had a relative who worked there for many, many years and has since retired many years ago. And to this day, this person will not discuss that they even worked there. They have a code of honor or whatever you might want to call it, but they do not talk about the fact that they even exist or anything about it. And it's just extremely surprising that it's so tight and so tight-lipped.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary culture of secrecy. It's funny, there's a story that I tell in the book about how There was a story a lot of people heard a few years ago about an American plane which crashed midair with a Chinese jet, and then ended up landing, and there was that standoff when the plane was actually at a Chinese military base.
Yeah, Hunan Island.
Yeah, exactly. What a lot of people don't realize is that that was an eavesdropping plane, mm-hmm. and it had 24 eavesdroppers in it. Mm-hmm. And there's actually been a report done by the Pentagon which described this incident after the fact. And it turns out that you had these 24 eavesdroppers on the plane, and they suddenly collided with this Chinese jet, and they started losing altitude fast, and the pilot couldn't control the plane. And as they're proceeding to what, you know, in their minds was probably going to be a crash landing in China, these people on the plane didn't start praying or crying or trying to telephone their relatives. They all started shredding documents.
And destroying equipment.
Because they were worried that the plane would land, and what would the Chinese find out? And at a certain point, literally, as the plane is plummeting down, one of them had a battle axe and was taking an axe to equipment. And it's amazing, if just reading that, what occurs to me is that that's an incredibly strong instinct. Mm. I mean, certainly an instinct that I wouldn't have.
Yes. I've even known people who are just nothing but clerks there. I used to live very close to Fort Meade, and they won't even speak. I mean, the janitors won't even speak.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's absolutely amazing. Very good.
Thank you. Okay.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments, invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Can we have too much secrecy? Are there unintended consequences from too much?
Yes. I mean, this is actually one of my biggest arguments is that I feel as though while there are definite legitimate needs for operational secrecy, the kind of culture of classification and secrecy has grown out of control. With a whole series of consequences that are not good. I mean, yes, secrecy obviously protects operations, but it also can mask incompetence and mismanagement and corruption and privacy violations. It's very hard for us to make these agencies accountable when they're not even necessarily accountable to Congress. And I feel as though, I mean, if you actually just look at the numbers, you begin to get a sense of this. The U.S. government creates roughly 40,000 new secrets every day. That's 40,000 individual classification decisions every day. The apparatus for maintaining the classification system now costs taxpayers $5 billion a year. Now, obviously some of these secrets are important secrets, but a lot of them aren't. To give you one example, the aggregate number that the United States government spends on intelligence every year, the total budget for all intelligence, is a secret. We know it's roughly $40 billion. And the argument goes that if it came out that it was 39.5 or 41.2, that Al-Qaeda or other adversaries would somehow change their strategies and their way of doing business. This is a suggestion that I resist. And there's actually a constitutional requirement, an explicit requirement in the Constitution, that budgets be published at some reasonable interval. And it actually gets even more absurd. There's a guy who I met during my research who filed a Freedom of Information Act request for the aggregate budget for 1997. And at first, the agencies really resisted, but he pushed on with his case, and eventually they did reveal that we had spent roughly $37 billion on intelligence in 1997. And so, emboldened by this, he looked back in the record and he realized that the aggregate intelligence budget for 1947 was still classified.
Mm-hmm.
And this would seem to be a number, you know, that would be of probably of some interest to historians, but none whatsoever to our enemies. And so he approached the agency and filed another Freedom of Information Act request and said, could you tell me the aggregate number for 1947? And they said, we'd love to, but it would jeopardize national security. To me, this is a culture of secrecy that's spun a little out of control.
Yeah. And also, I wonder if it gives us a false sense of security.
How so?
That we're listening in all the time, and you know, we're safe, but it's clear we're not safe. But do you know what I'm saying?
I do, and I think that is one of the issues, is that secrecy masks mismanagement. It actually is a way of preventing us from realizing that a lot of the time these agencies aren't doing their job the way they're supposed to be, or they've sort of put too much, you know, too many resources in one direction or not in another. To give you an example, just recently it emerged almost by accident that the single largest expenditure in this year's intelligence budget is a satellite. It's a photo reconnaissance satellite that will be able to photograph things from overhead, though only, it turns out, during the day and with clear skies. And it's going to cost $9.5 billion. And what's interesting about this is that in the years since September 11th, there seems to have been a consensus, and it was certainly the understanding in the joint congressional investigation of 9/11 and then the 9/11 Commission's report, that we really need to be investing more in human spies and not so much in sort of fancy new technologies. But what's interesting is that nevertheless, we end up, I think, making this rather misguided, massive expenditure. Actually, there was a guy from the Department of Defense who said, when told what the price tag on this satellite would be, said, for that kind of money, you could build a whole new CIA. But this is not a story most Americans know about, and because it's not out there on the front pages, it's not something that gets debated, and in my view, the agencies aren't held accountable, and when they're not, we end up rather less safe than we might otherwise be.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Indiana on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I'm going to ask one question. I'm going to hang up. I haven't heard you talk about basically what this is all about, encryption. I'm an old shortwave listener, and, you know, I've taken digital broadcast off the air. You know, we're encrypted from the Navy ships to each other. So basically what you're doing is trying to get people someplace where they can eavesdrop and then take that information and then try to find the code to break it. I was wondering if you talked anything about that at all. And this thing about Osama, you know, that sounds like God in the machine to me. I just don't think these boys are that naive. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Patrick?
I wish I didn't catch the last part. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that I kind of think that maybe the listener, I don't know, he's gone. He had to hang up. That I think he might have misinterpreted what we said about Al-Qaeda and how sophisticated they are. In fact, you've said that they are very sophisticated and they're very high-tech adept. And I think he somehow didn't hear that.
I got that the other way.
Yeah, I got it the other way.
I mean, I should just to clarify, I mean, we know that as well as training, actually this on the encryption note, we know that in the training camps in Afghanistan and Yemen, Al-Qaeda trainees are instructed not just with guns and explosives, but also in computer encryption. We know that when our special forces guys went into caves in Afghanistan that Al-Qaeda had been in, one of the things they found was manuals describing the overhead orbit of American intelligence satellites. So, no, these guys are actually quite sophisticated when it comes to the technological side. As for the question about cryptography, which is a really important one, it's not something I deal with at great length in my book, if only because there are actually some very good books out there about cryptography and the way it's working. But again, this is a sort of an arms race situation where, you know, somebody comes up with a strong code, somebody else comes up with a way to break it, then you come up with a stronger code, and it goes back and forth. One of the issues in this country has been a desire to limit the export of strong encryption so that if some new unbreakable algorithm comes out, do you make it available to the American people, but is there some way of then limiting it so that it doesn't leave this country? And I think as far as a practical matter, that's proved impossible. One question is whether the NSA actually negotiates backdoors into various encryption algorithms, so that, you know, when new technologies become available, they go on the market, or they become or something that can be accessed by the average person. But what we don't realize is that the agency actually has a backdoor into it. And then finally, they're working very hard to break codes all the time. I mean, we know that the NSA is the single largest employer of mathematicians on the planet, that it consumes more computer power than any organization on the planet. All of this is going toward breaking various codes.
Yeah. We had a listener call in who wanted to kind of follow up on the last caller. And this listener said, you know, did Osama really need to be informed in a news article that his phone was tapped?
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that actually gets us into another thing, which is how useful is all of this, how useful is all of this eavesdropping? How useful are all these gadgets if they know we're listening? And yeah, I mean, you wonder, it just, actually a story came out just 10 days ago that some kind of communication, we don't know if it was a phone call or an email or what have you, had been intercepted between Osama bin Laden and Zarqawi in Iraq. And I can't help but think that if we got that, bin Laden expected us to, that we are probably at this point, especially when it comes to him, we're hearing only what he wants us to. And that's significant in a number of ways. I mean, first of all, because, for instance, with this the satellite I just talked about, that's our biggest intelligence expenditure this year, it takes photos from space. And, you know, who would we take photos of? Well, Al-Qaeda knows we're watching. It knows we have, it's a matter of public record that we have 100 military and intelligence satellites in space. Certainly the Iranians and the North Koreans, we know when they do their nuclear tests, they're doing them underground. I actually spoke with the... you know, India had this big nuclear test in 1998 in the desert southwest of Delhi, and it was a big intelligence failure on our part because we didn't see it coming. And I spoke to the guy who was the American ambassador to India at the time and said, "Wow, well, we must have had satellites." And he said, "Yes, but the Indians knew we had satellites, and so whenever our satellites were coming overhead, they would put their stuff underground." And what he said is, "If I had just had one human spy in the atomic agency, it would have been much more helpful to me." So this issue of them knowing that we're watching or listening is incredibly significant, I think.
Yeah. We've only got a couple minutes left, and I want to talk a little bit here before we have to wrap things up about privacy. Early in the book, you quote a computer scientist, Mark Weiser, as saying the most profound technologies are those that disappear. Then later you write, the air around us and the sky above us, a riot of signals. To intercept those signals is as easy as putting a cup out in the rain. Couple of questions here. There are those who believe that privacy as we once knew it has ceased to exist. You note that early in the going in your book. Do you think privacy is extinct? And, you know, is the average American being listened to? Should the average American be concerned about being listened to?
I wouldn't say it's extinct, but I think it's certainly endangered and on the way to extinction. I mean, one thing I realized certainly in my research was that when you make a phone call or send an email, you might as well be sending a postcard, because it can be intercepted by any number of people, not just the agencies, but you know, some hacker with gear they picked up at Radio Shack could do it. What I worry about is that 5 years from now, we will be in a place where I could take your name or your Social Security number and put it into a database and retrieve your last 10 phone calls, your last 10 emails, your last 10 credit card transactions. If your cell phone has a GPS chip in it, I can find out where you are. There's a big push for that kind of total surveillance right now, not just on the part of the intelligence agencies, but on the part of private companies, which I think see a bit of a gold rush going on. If they can persuade the Department of Defense that their new silver bullet technology, generally a surveillance technology of some sort, will keep us a little bit safer, there's a big lucrative contract for them there. I feel as though those changes are happening right under our noses, and we should be discussing them and debating them more.
Yeah. There, we have to leave it. We're out of time. Patrick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Patrick Radden Keefe has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping. The book is published by Random House. 10 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, in the bean pit after several weeks of moving higher and a couple of weekdays in there, futures in the nearby May contract were up at a high of 691.5, and they were above the unchanged mark quite a ways today, but they turned lower by the end of the day, down 7.5 cents to settle at 673.5. November contract, 635.5, we're down 8.5. We'll take a complete look at those numbers in just a bit, and we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. We'll find out whether he thinks this is the start of the end of this rally, whether we'll get to an exhaustion phase and gap down some point, maybe overnight tonight, or whether there's some upside left in this marketplace with the potentials of that 720, 770 area, depending on what happens with all the outside money that has been funneled into the commodity markets, including in the wheat pit. It had been having quite a run up to, 375 or thereabouts yesterday. Today had a high of 368.5 in the nearby May contract, the low at 360.5, settlement price at $3.61. They were off 7 cents for the day. July futures, a 375 high. That's for your harvest month, low at 367.5. And a settlement price at 368, and they were down 7 cents for the day as well. September futures 379.5 in the wheat pit, the high, the low at 372, settled $3.72.75, down 7.25. And December wheat a 388 high, low at $3.79, settled at 380, down 8. March contract in the wheat pit 392.5, the high, the low at 385, settlement price at $3.85. They were off 8 for the day. And the May corn 229.75, the high, the low at 225.25, settlement price at 225.5, down 3 cents. July futures were off 2.25, 237 the high, the low at 32.5, and a settlement price at $2.33 in the July, down 2.25. September contract in the corn pit, 242.25 the high, low at 238.25, settled on that low, down 2 cents. And the December futures, 249 the high, the low at 45.75, settled a penny above that at $2.46.75 a bushel, down 3/4 for the December corn futures at the Board of Trade. March contract, 254.5 the high, the low at 251.25. The new corn in the March, 252.25, down 1. And the new May contract, 257.75, the high for the 06, the low at 254.75. And May 2006 corn settled $2.55.5. They were down 3/4 on the day. May oats, a 159.25 high, low at 55.5. A settlement price at 56 cents, down 2.75. And the July oats, 154.5 the high, the low at $1.51.25, settled $1.51.75. They were down 2.25 for the day. From the soy complex now, nearby May beans, a 691.5 high, low at 672, settlement price at $6.73.5. They were off 7.5. July, 696 the high, the low at 678. Settled 678.75, down 6. And the August soybeans, 692.5 the high, the low at 675.5. Settled 676, even, down 6.5 cents. September futures, 668.5, even the high, the low at $6.53. Settled 655.5, down 4.5. And the November beans, $6.46 the high, the low at 633.5. Settled 635.5, and they were down 8.5 cents for the day. January soybeans now, 647 the high, the low at 634, settled 635.25. They were off 9.75 for the day. May bean meal, 205 the high, the low at 197.50, settlement price at 197.90. They were down 430 for the day. And the July bean oil, 207.80 the high, the low at 201, settled 201.10. They were down 330. Hey, before we get to the bean oil, I want to remind you that tomorrow night, despite the fact that the Illini are playing, they won't start until about 8:40 Central Time. That gives you time, if you're in the DeKalb County area, to join us for about an hour from 7 to 8 o'clock, when Wayne Nelson and Mike Zuzulo and Bill Biederman will be on hand for a WILL Ag Outlook meeting. You'll have time to come to the meeting, get an update on what's happening at the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange, especially how that Brazilian bean crop is coming along and what it might mean for the future of your markets here in the U.S., whether we're at the exhaustion point of this move higher, and there might be a gap lower sometime in the future, and if there will be another rally at some point on potential problems in the crop here in the U.S. That all happens tomorrow. We can talk about it at 7 o'clock. It's at the DeKalb County Farm Bureau building. That's near Sycamore. It also happens to be the University of Illinois Extension Building. We hope to see you then. And as always, it's free. Now, bean oil futures, May contract, 24.52 the high. Low at 23.97, at settlement price at 24.15. They were off 8 for the day since, that is. And July bean oil, a 24.65 high, low at 24.10, and a settlement price at 24.39. And they were down 5. And just to be sure, we will be done before the Illini start. Celeste Quinn is now here. She's got a look at the number of the, from the Mercantile Exchange. Celeste, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Todd. Thank you very much. It looks like it was a mixed day today on the Mercantile Exchange. It looks like feeder cattle finished largely lower. Live cattle mixed, but lean hogs and March bellies finished higher. March feeder cattle, the high today, 106.35, the low 105.70, the settlement 106.05, that down 2.5. April 105.20, the high 104.10, the low 104.70, the settlement, that down a nickel. May feeder cattle 104.15, the high 103.10, the low 103.90, the settlement, that up 17.5. April live cattle 89.50, the high 88.60, the low 89.67.5, the settlement, that down 7.5. June live cattle 86.50, the high 85.25, the low 86.20, the settlement, that up 32.5. April lean hogs 72.35, the high today, the low 70.95, the settlement 71.27.5, that finishing up 70. May 78.90, the high 77.20, the low 78.62.5, the settlement, that up 142. June 81.05, the high 79.40, the low 80.65, the settlement, that up 160. July 78.45, the high 77.17.5, the low, the settlement 78.17.5, that up 135. March bellies 90.50, today's high, the low was 89.60. And that's where they ended up the day today, 89.60, and that up 160. The Dow is off 111 points at 10,634. The NASDAQ down 18 at 2017. The S&P 500 down 10 at 1187.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Alan Rossheim from Lancaster, South Carolina writes, Dear Dr. Science, I've heard that by putting aluminum foil somewhere in the front of your car, you can defeat radar. Any truth to this? If so, where exactly would you place it?
As far as I can tell, that tired rumor was started by a bored highway patrolman who got his kicks watching aluminum foil-covered cars come speeding down the road. No, modern law enforcement radar is much too sophisticated to be fooled by a tin foil apron. You can, however, confuse the arresting officer if you wrap your entire body in tin foil and then claim to be an alien life form when he pulls you over. Remember to punch two holes for your eyes and one for your mouth, or you may expire before he gives you the ticket. Practice speaking pig Latin, interspersed with chirping noises before trying this, in order to pull off a convincing performance. Hey, and good luck!
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree.